Chapter 6 Nicky. In which, piece by piece, all that our hero knows of his life, his music, his finances, and his attitude toward oral sex comes crashing down. Hi, I'm calling for Randy. I believe that you are my half-brother. If your father is Frank Ferrana, could you please call me? I don't know if he is dead or alive. My mother was Deanna, and my name is Nicky, or Frank. That was the message I left Randy Ferrana. An hour later, his wife called me back and said that she vaguely remembered his father mentioning a half-brother. I talked to Randy later that night. He was 4 years older than me, ran a vacation resort in San Jose, and had grown up on Motley Crue records, though he had no idea he was banging his head to the music of a blood relation. I knew of a lady named Deanna, he said, and I heard she had a son with my dad. But he never mentioned you. My dad, our dad, was a womanizer and a raging alcoholic. He was a wild man, I've been told. But is he alive? I asked. I want to talk to him. He died on Christmas Day in 1987. He had a heart attack in the shower. Randy told me that our father was buried in San Jose. I had really wanted to meet my dad after all these years, to just look at him and find out more about who I was, what I would become, and even what diseases I was genetically prone to. Most of all, I wanted to know why he never wanted to have anything to do with me my whole life. Since he was dead and buried, I figured that was the end of that. I was probably better off not finding him alive, because I only would have been rebuked again and further embittered. I remembered all the optimistic thoughts I entertained when I flew to Seattle to reunite with my mother, only to find a paranoid woman in a mental hospital who would never forgive me and who I could never forgive. Donna encouraged me to follow through with my plan of making peace with my father. His death was not a setback, I finally decided, but an advantage, because that way he couldn't talk back to me. So we flew to San Jose and visited his grave. Donna brought along a video camera and filmed me walking through the cemetery, finding his tombstone and spitting on it. Fuck you, I yelled at him. You fucking walk out on me when I'm 3. Don't even say goodbye. Then you come back with a sled like that's going to make everything okay. You don't even stick around to see me. Why'd you even bother? I sat there for an hour, blaming him for my entire fucked up life. When I rewound everything, running away from my mother, stealing a homeless girl's clothes, fighting with the cops outside the whiskey, overdosing at the Franklin. All that misanthropy and self-destruction came down to the same thing. A massive chip I had been carrying on my shoulder my whole life because my father had abandoned me. Not only had he left me at 3, but he had pushed me away when I reached out to him for help 16 years later. When I returned home, we were on the verge of leaving for the Generation Swine Tour. I decided to exercise my feelings for my father once and for all on stage. I composed a bass piece with Chris Vrenna of Nine Inch Nails, in which I soloed over all these different textures and soundscapes while a series of slides flashed in the background. The images were of an embryo, a child being born, a cute baby photo of myself, and a picture of me when I was a happy little kid in a Halloween mask. Then the music darkened, and a series of words flashed across 2 40-inch wide screens. Abandonment, vacant, heroin, destruction. Then the music stopped, and a big question mark appeared, as if to say, why me, or what next? To close the piece, I played dark ambient noise and short minor key melodies on the bass, as the film Donna and I had made at my father's graveside played in the background. The first night I performed the solo, my eyes brimmed with tears. Afterward, fans backstage said that they had cried too because they had also been abandoned by their fathers. Of course, other people came up and just said I was a freak and should deal with my issues. But that was my way of dealing with them. It was through Randy that I found out about my full sister, Lisa. My mother had always told me that Lisa had left home and did not want anyone in the family to find or visit her, so I hadn't thought much about her. Randy couldn't believe it when I told him. Lisa wasn't even capable of making a decision like that. She had Down syndrome and had been living in a home somewhere, he wasn't sure where exactly, for over 30 years. She was blind, mute, and unable to walk, put on her clothes, or feed herself. As I ran around the world worrying about my band and what drugs I could put in my system, she had been sitting all that time in a wheelchair in some rest home for invalids. I swore to track her down when the Generation Swine tour ended and do everything in my power to make sure she had the best care money could buy. I couldn't understand why my mother never bothered to tell the truth. My whole life I'd been blowing around the world like a sapling without roots. My parents were lost to me, and as for my children, every day I was fighting to keep them as Brandy vilified me in court, which wasn't a difficult feat considering my past. Now, 3 decades too late, I finally learned that there were others out there like me. 8 years of sobriety, 6 years of marriage, and the responsibility required to raise 3 children had cleared my head for the first time. And as I looked around, I had a revelation. My life sucked. I became angrier than ever, and I wanted to start getting high again, but we had a rule on the tour that each time someone was caught drunk or high, he had to pay $25,000. We wanted to be at the top of our game live, not vomiting and passing out on the side of the stage. To make sure no one cheated, we had a guy on the road administering random urine tests. Vince, of course, was busted within the first 2 weeks. The Sober Swine Tour was supposed to be our big reunion. The world was supposed to rise up and chant Motley Crue just because Vince was back. But the truth was that we still weren't Motley Crue. Sure, all the members were there, but the tour was a mess, with click tracks and backing tapes and racks of effects attempting to imitate the studio experimentation of the album. We were more a computer than a band on stage. When we played Livewire, I felt a rush of excitement because the song was organic. When we played Find Myself, it felt as cold as karaoke. Though Vince was back in the band singing, I could tell he wasn't happy. Part of the problem was that, as Kovac had predicted, Elektra was shafting us on publicity, promotion, and marketing. And with our morale as low as it was, Tommy wanting to modernize, Mick still pissed because we had lost faith in him, Vince in financial hell, and all my family problems, it wasn't going to be very hard for Elektra to lay on the extra straw to break Motley's back. And we couldn't let that happen because if we broke up, we'd owe them $12 million. If we stayed together, they'd owe us $12 million. Elektra soon stopped paying us, hoping to drive us further into debt and desperation. They tried to get to us through our wives and lawyers, planting insecurities about the band's future. They even tried to get at us through Pamela's manager, telling her that Tommy was the star of Motley Crue and we'd be better off on his own. They came at us from every angle. So we went to war. As far as we were concerned, the Generation Swine Tour was not just an attempt to promote an album and a band, but a way to get the label to pay attention to us, to give us our money and release us from our contract so we could be free to do what we wanted. So, from the stage, I had the audience chant, "Fuck Elektra." I arranged for an interview in Spin magazine for the sole reason of having the opportunity to call Sylvia Rhone a cunt in print. I was determined to be the most painful thorn in her side. After all, this was a label that made all its money from rock and roll, from us, from Metallica, from AC/DC, but had now disavowed it. A label so stupid that as they were squeezing us, they were also dropping an English group called The Prodigy because they thought the band had no future. Less than a year later, The Prodigy signed a multi-million dollar deal with Maverick Records and became the first techno band to ever have a number one record in America. My plan was to make Elektra so sick of us that they'd do anything to let us go. Now, I realize that probably wasn't the best tactic. I committed the mistake of making it personal with Sylvia, so that she felt she was being abused and taken advantage of. And that led her to think that I was mean and deserved everything I got, so she tightened the screws on us further, without a thought for the fact that we had children and homes, and we were all now for the first time in our lives having trouble paying for them. It was a dark period. I still didn't know that much about the business, how it worked, and how deep and high up the chains of command went. I'd never been on the wrong side of the record label before, or imagined that Motley Crue would be caught between the cogs of a machine that wanted to crush it. At the same time, I was losing my grip on what Motley represented. I was so angry at my father and my ex-wife and my record label that my dark, demented side took over. For the Swine Show, Tommy had found some bootleg footage of people committing suicide and getting burned to death. It was gruesome stuff, and the idea was to screen these atrocities during our anti-suicide song, Flush, to show the audience that, no matter how miserable they were, they still had it pretty good. But when I looked out at the audience during the song, they all looked terrified. I remembered too late that kids don't go to a Motley Crue concert to think about their own mortality. They go to a Motley Crue concert to hopefully get a blowjob in the backseat of a car. And then, when our morale couldn't have been any lower and our relationship with Elektra couldn't have gotten any worse, Vince decided to quit the band again.